Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, listeners, Kevin and I need your help.
Yes, we need your help. Please, please, please. We need your stars.
We need your reviews, you guys, on iTunes so we can start to climb those iTunes rating charts.
It's simple. Open iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on Ratings and Reviews. Under the Customer Reviews, click Write a Review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
If you need some help, think of 1 star being Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the Road Company of the last 5 years, and 5 stars being free front row tickets to Hamilton. Although, when you think about it, I actually would give 5 stars to the Road Company of Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the last 5 years, because I think that would be awesome.
I would love to hear, can I hear Moving Too Fast as Paul? that's the one I really want.
She's a Shakespeare goddess. Been through Erica Schwartz and Danica Weiss and the Handelman twins.
So there you go. You can also leave a comment if you like.
That's it. That's
your reviews.
It.
Send us your reviews, please. Friends.
Hi, and welcome back to part 2 of our interview with the wonderful Richard Maltby Jr. Just so you're aware, we've had a few sound issues with this particular recording, but we've tried to work them out to the best of our ability. Thanks so much, and enjoy part 2 of Richard Maltby Jr.
Since I don't think we asked you originally on our first day, that I'd love to get an answer to is exactly how did the collaboration between you and Mr. Shire come about?
Oh, well, we met in freshman year at Yale. I had gone to a prep school where I'd written a musical in my senior year, and I went to Yale as opposed to Harvard because Yale had a theater and Harvard didn't at the time. And David came from Buffalo, where he had gone to a prep school, and he came with a complete score to a musical. Ballads, comedy songs, up-tempo, the Beguine.
Yeah.
In those days, the Beguine.
Bill Charmsong.
He didn't have a book, a story, or characters, or lyrics, but he had the score for the musical, and he thought that people would just take it and just make a musical out of it.
Why not?
So I thought he was this asshole hick from Buffalo, and he thought I was this pretentious twit from Exeter, and we were both right. So,
still friends today.
Well, we weren't at first. We, you know, neither of us really wanted to work with the other. But there was no other alternative. There was...
Yeah, who else is going to write?
Else,
yeah.
You know, we looked around and basically David was the only one who wanted to write music, and I was the only one who wanted to write a musical. So whether we liked it or not, we got together. And every now and then I think, wasn't I lucky to get a world-class composer out of that?
I mean,
I could have gotten anybody. I could have gotten, you know, any number of... there were, in subsequent years, some people who came to write musicals who were not nearly as good as, you know, in terms of composing as
right.
he was.
He really set the bar, too. I mean...
he did. He was... He once he found his voice, which took a little bit of doing, he started to explode. I mean, we used to... When we first came to New York, we would always meet with Sondheim, and we would play our songs, and he'd play his songs. Oh, wasn't that cute?
Show and tell with Sondheim.
It was show and tell. It was... Well, he hadn't produced... Forum or any of the Hal Prince shows or Do I Hear a Waltz, and he was he'd done those the two biggies, and was complaining because nobody in the world wanted him as a composer. They wanted to write lyrics all, you know. So we got together and he would complain and everything. I know for a fact because I confirmed with Jonathan Tunick that Sondheim got a lot of chords from David.
I believe that.
He admits it. I mean, he accepts it and writes lovely notes every now and then.
When did you decide?
He also did many more things for us. He also got us an agent. He got us a publisher. He was a very really great help and.
And did you just look him up when you came to New York? I mean, obviously you knew Steve Sondheim was someone that... But no, because this would have been like the...
He was just the lyricist of Gypsy and West Side Story, right? Yeah. That was not exactly chopped liver.
Right.
No, David and I wrote two shows at Yale, and then when we graduated, we wrote another show that was going to be done at... it was called The Sap of
Life.
Yeah, and it was done at Sheridan Square. We tried it out at Williamstown.
Mm-hmm.
And it was our ripoff of the Fantastics. I mean, there'd never been a little musical before, and so we thought, oh well, we could do that. And it had a rather mindless story, but it had a bunch of very interesting songs, and it ran 6 weeks. But somewhere in the first or second week, Steve came, and then he came back. And brought Hal Prince, and then he came back and brought Jerry Robbins.
Wow!
And Leonard Bernstein, and so that's how we met him.
That's incredible! Such generosity.
Really,
in those days, there wasn't a direct route. There wasn't a route of any sort for new writers, to get into the mainstream. And so people like Hal, who were adventurous, were thrilled when some new voice came along, and so they were incredibly, supportive.
Were there any lyricists or composers that you were looking at the time beside Mr. Sondheim that you thought their work was just incredible and you were admiring their craftsmanship?
Well, my personal idol was Sheldon Harnick.
Mm.
When I was at Yale, Fiorello came through. I think I saw the Body Beautiful.
He did, yes.
Oh, yeah.
I saw that, but... but it was the Fiorello came through, which had really, really deft lyrics. And then She Loves Me opened, and She Loves Me, David went to see it before I did, which is unusual. And he said, there's this show. And it's really interesting. And so I went off to see it. I mean, the lyrics in that are just flawless. And they all seem... exactly like human speech, except their song. And, that's always been my model. I don't know where I got that from, but I just bothered me, and it wasn't human speech. And so I would just work very hard until it became... If you took away the music, you'd still say the same thing.
Can we talk a little bit about Love Match, or How Do You Do, I Love You?
Sure. I mean, we actually, our first years in New York were, checkered. well, we got to know Streisand, and she recorded five of our songs, so that that's good.
That's
huge. We did a review called Graham Crackers with Ronnie Graham at the upstairs at the downstairs.
I hate to interrupt. For our listeners, the name Ronnie Graham comes up a lot. Would you explain a little bit about who he was and why he was so influential?
Well, Ronnie Graham was a comedian, a really inventive, madcap comedian. And he was the central comic in New Faces of 1952, which was maybe the only really, really successful New Faces that, you know, that was done. It's still kind of a model for everybody. So he did television shows and other things like that. And then he did this. He was going to do this show at the upstairs and the downstairs, which we decided ought to be called Graham Crackers.
Nice, you know.
Huge.
I love it.
But he was a person who went to the Dr. Feelgood of the time, the one that Alan Jammerner was.
Who had the vitamins that he would prescribe.
Yeah, the vitamins with some other secret
exactly.
ingredient, which
yeah.
was, you know, some kind of upper. Anyway, they were all.
Can we talk a little bit about Love Match?
Sure. I mean, we actually, our first years in New York were, checkered. well, we got to know Streisand, and she recorded five of our songs, so that's good.
That was huge.
We did a review called Graham Crackers with Ronnie Graham at the upstairs at the downstairs.
Oh, yeah.
A comedian, a really inventive, madcap comedian, and he was the central comic in New Faces of 1952, which was maybe the only really, really successful New Faces that, you know, that was done. It's still kind of a model. So he did television shows and other things like that, and we decided not to be called Graham Crackers.
Nice.
Cute.
I love it.
But for secret
exactly,
ingredient,
yeah,
was, you know, some kind of upper. Anyway, he would spout these. That in the show, and he'd say, "But what in the show?" It's, he never remembered what he had just done, and he didn't have any kind of sense of focus. It was all, you know, he was theoretically directing the show. And, one time, I David and I were close to the opening, and we had went off after a rehearsal, and we'd sort of had enough. Ronnie had to come in and sort of take charge. So we had a little dinner, then we went back to the club to tell him that we were going to, that he had to take charge. So he was there with just the three of us, and he said, you know, talk. And so I started to do my really large and impassioned speech. And as I was doing it, he took out this little zipper bag, and he opened it up and took out this rolled up his sleeve, took out this plastic tube, put it around his arm, filled a syringe with something out of a bottle. Now, somewhere along here, I completely lost my train of thought. I was no longer able to focus as he, you know, oh, I can't find a vein. It's kind of hard to find one, you know. Keep talking, he would say. Keep talking. And I'm going, I by now had totally forgotten anything I was planning to say. He said, it's just vitamins. It's just vitamins. It was not just vitamins.
That is the legendary Ronnie Graham.
That is the legendary Ronnie Graham.
No, for our listeners.
He was like so many of those madcap comics, you know, the real world was not a place for them. Jonathan Winters and right. you know, he was like that, you
yeah.
know. Robin Williams in a way, mm-hmm. Who at least could control himself doing a part, but... he was one of those off-the-wall zanies who was hysterically funny, and real life was always a problem.
Gotcha. Well, that gives us a little glimpse into who Ronnie Graham was. My gosh. And so now let's go back to Love Match, or How Do You Do I Love You? I'm so sorry because I cut you off when you were mentioning Mr. Graham's name.
How Do You Do I Love You? We were working on a show of our own that would have been rather interesting because the main character would have been mute all through the show. And it was really a satire on the modern world, and she never had a chance. She never spoke.
Wow.
So, for some reason, Julie Stein picked it up, and he was going to produce it. But we needed to expand the story. One of the people we went to was Michael Stewart, who didn't really like our show. No professional would have because, you know, had this sort of problem.
Right.
Main character who didn't sing.
Doesn't.
Actually, it would have been a great show. She would have been a dancer. She would have, would have been a really interesting part. But anyway, he said no, but he had another idea for a show about a woman who finds a man through what we would call today computer dating. But in those days, it was that she got a job in an insurance company and used the computers of the insurance company to zero in on the perfect guy for her.
How cute and how clever.
And ahead of its time.
Well, I don't know. It seems like it was ahead of its time, but it was a real cornball musical. But nobody was asking us to do anything else, so we said yes. And we did it. It starred Phyllis Newman. It played the music tense, Lee Goober was the producer of it. He was at that time married to Barbara Walters, who kept walking in on our meetings.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a nice experience. We hired Jonathan Tunick to be the orchestrator, and it was like his first show or one of his very first shows. It gave us our great experience. We opened in some place in Maryland, and we knew that there was one review coming out in the weekly paper. We didn't know. I mean, it was a real small town.
Right? Yeah,
and. It finally came out, I think, on a Friday, so we went off to the drugstore to buy the newspaper, and we opened it up. We were looking through it, and we couldn't find it. And it was a show called How Do You Do I Love You. The headline read, "Goodbye, I Hate You."
Oh!
And proceeded to pan everything in the show. I always think this is kind of marvelous, because that was our first professional review. And truthfully, if you get that as your first review, they can never hurt you again.
Nowhere to go but up.
What a good attitude.
Yeah, right? You develop a thick skin early on.
You never develop a thick skin, but you realize that there's nothing, nothing worse that they can say about
That's
you.
That's true.
One of the other things we didn't talk about last week that we should talk about, because we've had two-thirds of the cast on our show
starting now.
Yeah, we've interviewed Lonnie and we've interviewed George.
And not Marjorie?
Not yet. Yes. Not yet.
She's around.
Yeah. We'll get the triple crown. Yes. The triple crown there. Where did the desire come from to create this show?
Well, it came from Lynn Meadow, actually. I suppose we sort of skipped over Love Match, which was...
Oh, I'm so sorry. We can go back.
Just for chronology.
Yes.
The one thing about How Do I Love You was that it was the first time we decided we would use rock and roll as the natural vocabulary of the younger characters, which had never happened before. There were, shows were beginning to have the rock number or the pop number, but they were always sort of like set pieces stuck into a show about something else. And we thought we could actually make it the vocabulary of the main characters.
Yeah.
So, which had never been done before. As a result, David Merrick and Bert Bacharach came out to see the show and hired Jonathan and hired a musical director because, you know, that for Promises, Promises, because that was the breakthrough that they were, you know, working towards. And we, to our great dismay, having broken ground in a kind of a modern kind of sound, got offered a musical about Queen Victoria and Albert. That's what Love Match is. We were brought in to sort of doctor it. You know, can you write this song? And we did. And then, well, why don't you write that song too? And slowly we ended up at replacing the entire score and everything. It starred Patricia Routledge and Larry Guitard.
Oh, wow.
Hal Linden. It played in the Amundsen. And at that time, they were thinking that the West Coast would become a tryout place. Mm-hmm. So they needed a New Haven to go to. So they decided they were going to make Phoenix, Arizona, into their out-of-town tryout town. And so they renovated some big movie theater.
Wow.
What they didn't allow for is that theaters have staffs of people who do this all the time.
Right.
So we were there opening a really big musical with stagehands who didn't know, you know, stage right from stage left. And in our techs were... Our first preview, we had actually an audience, and we had told them that we might stop from time to time. We stopped, I think, about 10 minutes into the first act, and then again, and then again.
Oh.
And about midnight, we had barely reached the end of the first act.
Oh, my goodness.
And people started leaving because it was midnight. It was one of the first shows that Robin Wagner designed. It was one of the first shows that Jules Fisher designed.
Oh.
So we had some interesting people. And it was pretty, and it had some of the score was really, really wonderful. It was directed by Danny Daniels, who did three brilliant dances. But he wasn't really a director.
Right.
And the sort of supervisor of the show was a guy named Noel Willman, who had directed A Man for All Seasons.
Yeah.
And even though at one time Paul Scofield was famous for saying Noel Willman had nothing to do with the success of A Man for All Seasons, I guess he was lucky. He didn't really know anything about a musical, and you know, kept saying things like, "Well, get on with it, dear boy." the show opened in I guess we must have played in Phoenix. I don't even remember that, but we opened at the Amundsen, and did not get very good reviews. Although I must say, a couple of them were smart enough to single out the score, which was very nice.
Yes.
It had a book by a guy named Christian Hamilt, who had never written a musical before. And we had, after we opened at the Amundsen, there was this big production meeting about what we were going to do, because we were scheduled to go to the Fisher in Philadelphia, in Detroit, and come into New York. It was all a trajectory. And there was work that had to be done, and we sort of everybody agreed that we're going to do this and this and this. It was a lot. And as we were leaving the room, I was walking down the hall with Christian and David. And I said to Chris, what are we going to do? How are we going to do this? What are you going to do? And he said, nothing. And I said, what? I said, no, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to change anything. I said, but you have to. You have to. And he said, "No, I don't. I have a rich wife."
Oh, that's one way.
I mean, there was a total conversation stopper. You can't, you know.
No. How do you trump that?
How do you trump that? You just, you know, okay. You don't care whether the show succeeds or not because you have a rich wife.
My God almighty. Wow. Okay.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
That's my favorite theater anecdote in my life.
So it was a collection of music that you and Mr. Shire had written for various...
Yeah, we came back to New York. Hal Prince suggested to another producer that we work on a show that was about the same material that Red's was, making connections with some of his composer friends, Billy Goldenberg in particular, who were in California and getting all sorts of work because Universal had started working in the features and... and pretty soon he was moving out there. And it was about that time that I decided that I really wanted to be a writer, a director. So I just started my little training program. I was in the second show that David and I wrote at Yale.
Was that Cyrano or?
It was Grand Tour.
Oh, Grand Tour.
Grand Tour, which was Gretchen Cryer was the lead.
Amazing.
Nancy Ford was in it, also Austin Pendleton and Bill Hinnant. It was about a school teacher and so there was a classroom right at the beginning, so we needed a bunch of kids and she was one of the school kids, the tall girl she was, and we were very nice to her. Who knew, but it was a big deal for her. By the way, Peter Hunt did the lights and John Badham was the set stage manager. John Conklin did the set.
Wow.
So time flips some pages and we're now, she has graduated from Yale, is looking to become a director. And this guy had this idea of, in London, apparently there are theater clubs. There are places that are, and he person who was crazy enough to take it on, and with its $60,000 debt and everything else, I mean, it was pretty hopeless. But we had a theater on 73rd Street, the Bohemian Hall, and anyway, I sort of came in to help them do the benefit, their first benefit, which sort of saved them. And So I had reconnected with her and it did have a large cabaret space, a sort of a restaurant space. There was a whole bunch of shows that hadn't happened or that hadn't been produced or that were produced but weren't successful. And so it seemed like it had failure written all over it. But I thought, well, I wanted to... I became a director in order to do my own thing, so let's do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I got to say yes.
The one thing I knew that we were just going to do the songs. We were just not going to have sketches or anything. In those days, reviews always had sketches or a compare of some sort, like the compare in Side by Side by Song.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Somebody who sort of tells little anecdotes and sets up the song.
A little waka waka.
And I called up Lonnie Ackerman, who had been in How Do You Do, I Love You, and she said yes. There had been a girl who had done a very funny nightclub act, who was sort of a soprano, I called her up, and that was Marjorie, and she said yes. And I called up another guy, Michael Tucci, who was in Greece, and he said yes. So suddenly we had a cast, and I couldn't, I mean, I was astonished that people would say yes. And remember, I think I told you they were getting $25, not $25 a week, $25 yeah. for the 8-week commitment. 4 weeks of rehearsal and 4 weeks.
Amazing.
So we found a pianist and we went into rehearsal and we started teaching the songs and I kept putting off getting it on its feet because I really had no idea how to direct a musical. And so I took that moody opening is from The Sap of Life, Starting Here, Starting Now. It goes in Starting Here, Starting Now, which is that song. And then we had bunches of songs from different shows, comedy songs, ballads and everything. But we did just the opening with everybody singing I Am in Love, you know, that thing. And then Starting Here, Starting Now, which seemed to be a good way to start. And they sang it. And I didn't know what to do. So I said, do it again. And they sang it again. And I said, well, do it again. And I must have happened about 6 or 7 times. And finally, just out of desperation to maybe help me, Michael went over to one of the girls in the middle. And I thought, why didn't he go to the other one? And I thought, oh, I've got a plot. I've got a triangle. So then I put together the first 7 songs as a kind of a story of this boy in love with 2 girls or going after 2 girls, a kind of a sleaze bag. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So you're open to reordering.
Well, I had no order at that time.
It was just nothing.
It was just a bunch of songs. And then I put together a certain number of songs that became a little bit of a plot. And oh dear, what do you know? That was the first half of our act, and then we had 3 solo numbers, and then some group numbers, and suddenly the whole first act was there, and I followed that through on the second act. And in doing so, I invented the bookless musical, the bookless musical review, right. The review that doesn't have any that is connected by internal logic, not by any kind of interviewer or by sketches.
Right.
There were no words in the show at all. And that's how you invent. That's how you change the world.
There
it is.
Thank
God, folks. Michael crossed to that girl.
I know.
It was totally true. And from there on, you know, and then the show opened, and people wanted to move it. It took a great deal of effort to move it to a theater restaurant on 46th Street called Barbara Ann's had a little stage and it was very nice. We had a terrible time making a deal. We had to raise all of $25,000 to put it up, and it, you know, it was like it was like pulling teeth to get it. We actually, the major investor was this crook who is a friend of somebody's, some you know, show business has the dark side, and mm-hmm. somebody knew somebody, and they were going to commit to, I think, $20,000 or something like that. And we kept being told, you know, be on the corner of 42nd and 8th at 6 o'clock, and someone will come and give you. And they didn't come, and then different things that happened. And finally, Mary Jo Slater, who was one of the producers, got given this bag full of cash. A car came up, she climbed into it, was given a bag full of cash,
and
dropped off. And
I've never heard anything like this before.
I never heard anything about it, but years later, New York Magazine did an article about this guy, this sort of theatrical kind of, well, he wasn't even a theatrical, he was like a second level hood who was murdered.
And that was the guy who gave us the bag of money.
Oh my gosh.
And there's in the whole of the story, it goes on and on. And then there's this paragraph about how he dabbled in show business.
Well, I guess we're thankful because it kept your show alive.
The show got on, you know.
And was recorded, and you know, they toured the country. They, you know, it was
it was recorded. It got nominated for a Grammy. I mean, it was
yeah.
It just kept expanding and expanding and expanding. When we moved, we also, I mean, the show was made up of just songs that had existed, and it needed some sort of edgier songs. And so we wrote Flair, I Don't Remember Christmas.
I love that one.
I Don't Believe It, that, which was actually a melody from Love Match, but a new lyric and a new concept. And I think probably a couple of other things too as well. But the darker sort of edgier songs we wrote for that.
Yeah.
Specifically for the
and still around today. It's those songs appear in showcases and cabarets.
They
and
do.
They're still moving.
They're such good songs.
Still funny,
well,
they're still
character
moving.
Songs. And you see what
story songs.
What I realized was that people didn't write like us. And the reason why our songs were not treated well in the shows that we had done was that the directors didn't know what to do with them. They knew how to stage musicals. They knew how to stage a musical number. They didn't know how to make a scene. And so they would, and our songs are kind of deceptive. You know, they might have a kind of a recognizable kind of showbiz bounce to it that, it, you know, sort of telegraphs what the show is, what the song is. But in fact, the content of the song is quite different using that sort of sunny bounce as a kind of a character enriching element. I'm it's bouncy, but I'm actually saying something serious.
Right.
So, and people tended to miss that and, so when I was putting the show together, I made a lot of the mistakes that they made. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, oh no, that's not what the song is about. The song is really about this. And in song after song, I realized the depth of characterization, which I had taken for granted, was quite profound in these songs. They really, 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 they not only had to be acted, but they had to be understood. You know, right. In a character sense, they had to be understood. It was not just they didn't have to be just performed, but there was something. You know, that's our style, and I didn't think there was anything unusual about that until I realized that a lot of people don't write that way.
Exactly, with subtext and everything. I'm going to move us up to Song and Dance. How you directed that?
I did.
And how did you become involved with that project? This is a musical that Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote the music to.
Right, right. Tyler Gatchell of Gatchell and Neufeld were the kind of the big deal general managers of the time, and they did all of Andrew's shows. Tyler was one of the great men of the theater, and the two of them, when we were hopeless trying to move Starting Here, Starting Now, these two guys who were the biggest deal in New York took on this little show and were our general managers. I mean, they were so helpful. I mean, the theater is made up of those people. And they, they love the score. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't do that. You know, they just couldn't do enough for us. So after Baby opened, Andrew was looking for lyricists, as he always was. One time, I'll tell you this afterwards, when we were working, I was working with Don Black on the lyrics of the show, and we were going to visit Andrew at Sidmonton, which is out in the country. And you drive after you get off the main roads, you go through these little country roads, and the country roads are very narrow, and they have these huge hedges on each side, so that you're kind of driving to this like tunnel, and we're in the middle of nowhere, but the road we were on was just filled with cars, And I said to Don Black, who are all these people? Well, you know,
right.
And he said, lyricists.
That's good.
But it was like that. So Andrew at that time was interested in doing the aspects of love.
Right.
And so he flew me over to talk about that, and and he played me the songs that he said would be the score for Aspects of Love, and what he played me was the score to Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, wow!
They all went off into Phantom of the Opera,
right?
Because Phantom of the Opera came up first, and
fascinating.
And Aspects of Love had a real problem. It's really an interesting kind of cult novel. It has an absolutely breathtaking first chapter, and then it's like the writer didn't know what to do with it after that. And so the first chapter you want to put on the musical stage instantly, and after that. But in the course of it, he and Cameron had also done Song and Dance and in London, and they were looking for somebody who could perhaps come up with something it was two separate things, a song cycle in the right. first half and a ballet in the second. And
right.
was there any way that they could be combined? And so we need someone who's not only a director but also a writer, like you, Richard.
How convenient.
And so I didn't yes. do Aspects of Love, but I went home and wrote an outline of how the two stories could work together, and Andrew Cameron thought that was very clever, and so suddenly we were off on that. It involved rewriting a good deal of the first of the song cycle,
right?
And Cameron said, "Well, Don Black is totally signed off on this. You can just, you know, do whatever you like." And I said, "Fine, I'm writing and I'm about to really go to work on it." And so Cameron calls and says, "Well, actually, Don would really like to be involved." Turned out that Don contractually had to be involved.
Oh,
but and that he hadn't, in fact, signed off on it in that sense.
Yeah.
So Don came over with what would have been, it could have been unbelievably uncomfortable time because I'm sitting here rewriting his songs. And but he's a good fellow. He has a great sense of humor, and he went along with it, and we had a really good time. And we holed up in the Mayflower Hotel and rewrote the show.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now a question for you as a director. The second act of Song and Dance is completely choreographed. It's an all danced piece. Yeah. And then we're going to just jump forward for a quick second to Fosse, which you directed, which is also an entirely choreographed piece. So you are not a choreographer.
I am certainly not. No.
How does that relationship work?
Well, in Song and Dance, the first act is a song cycle. It's a one-woman show. You know, and I had the idea of Bernadette, an idea which, by the way, nobody liked.
Really?
Well, she wasn't Bernadette at that time.
Right.
She had done Mac and Mabel, which was and she'd done some movies and everything, but she wasn't a box office name.
Who would they have wanted?
Well, I don't know that they wanted anybody else, but they weren't impressed with that.
Okay.
But I talked them into it. And
wow.
She won her first Tony for it. So,
mm-hmm.
And the second act was a ballet to a piece of music, just variations. He wrote Andrew's brother is a cellist, world-class cellist. Right. And so he wrote a cello concerto for him and just decided that that would be the second act. And it starred a guy named Wayne Sleep, who was a small man, but a big sort of dancing star in London. So the first act was a one-woman show start with a star. The second act was a ballet with a star. Yeah. And I found a way to make one of the stories, one of the men that our heroine gets involved with, the second act is his story, and they finally, you know, they finally get together. And someone had the quite brilliant idea of, since we needed a world-class choreographer, asking Peter Martins, who had just taken over the New York City Ballet, to do it, and he had never done a musical. But I wrote out the entire plot of the dance. So to that extent, I wrote the ballet, and then he had the music, and then there was the story, and so he did that.
You wrote the structure of what should happen, getting you from point A to point B, and then it's his job to...
He took the story and the music, and then staged it. I mean, all the dancing was his.
Do you get so specific, as in measures 1 through 54... are
sometimes,
seeing the girl?
There would be, you know, if the music had a real dynamic to it, I would suggest that they build, and this happens on this moment. But a lot of it was his, and it you know, he's a brilliant guy, and it worked out really well.
Join us in 2 weeks for part 3 of our interview with Richard Maltby Jr.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.